Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. So Stephanie and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Lung Cancer. And this is a very important program and one that we're delighted to be able to offer to all of you. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have 877 participants from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom. So truly, it's a bit of a global call as well. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers have prepared. There's information about our speakers and about all of our collaborating organizations. And there also is an evaluation form. And we ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. We very much appreciate your feedback. Indeed, you often tell us the programs you would find helpful, and we want to be sure to keep these programs relevant to meet your needs. So you're the best people to tell us what we should be doing, what the topics should be, what you think of the programs. So do take that moment and let us know what you think and send back the evaluation. We very much appreciate that. Now, today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb and ImClom Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Eli Lilly and Company, and really want to thank them for their support of the program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is Chief Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Rain Chair in Thoracic Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He's also Professor of Medicine, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Criss is going to start this call off by presenting an overview of lung cancer, the current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and symptom and pain management. So it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Criss.
Thank you. Thank you, Carolyn. And I'm very happy to speak to you to all today about this illness. For truly, it is one that has undergone quite a transformation in our understanding over the last decade. Treatments are so much better, and there are so many more options available, and I'd like to share some of those developments with you today. I think the first thing that we need to know is the increasing realization among those studying lung cancer and treating lung cancer, that we have finally kind of come to grips with a very obvious fact, and that there is really no such thing as lung cancer. The disease is quite different from person to person. Again, within that one diagnosis, the course, the way it affects people's lives is quite different. And also, as we have learned more about the nature of lung cancer, studied tissue specimens to find what characteristics of the lung cancer cells make the lung cancer grow and conversely will lead to the death of the lung cancer, we've discovered that each lung cancer or group of lung cancers have a different biological or genetic characteristic. So one thing we've learned is we're not talking about lung cancer, it's lung cancers. And things that might apply to one type of the illness or to the illness in one person really do not apply to another person. So I think I'd be very, very careful as you think about what about your illness and what's the best approach to your illness, that you focus in on all the characteristics of it that define it, both the personal ones and the ones that we learn from biology. The other point to mention as we begin this discussion today is we're talking about cancer that started in the lung. Cancer can arise in any part of the body and can spread to the lung. So, for example, if you had breast cancer that had spread to the lung despite the successful initial treatment, that is not lung cancer. That is breast cancer in the lung, and it's treated with the strategies that are useful in fighting breast cancer. Lung cancer is a distinct Lung cancers are a distinct group of illnesses, and again, refer to those cancers that have begun in the lung. How do you determine if you have lung cancer? There is only one way to know if lung cancer is present, and that is to do a biopsy and to have a pathologist review the material taken from that biopsy and have that pathologist say that with 100% certainty, lung cancer is present. I think there is sometimes a misconception that lung cancer can be not diagnosed off an X-ray, off a scan, off a PET scan, that somehow a PET scan is a lung cancer test, or there are blood tests to diagnose lung cancer. That is not correct. The only way to diagnose lung cancer is to have a biopsy and have the pathologist say it is lung cancer. That pathologic study is also critical in determining the best kind of treatment for lung cancer, because when the pathologist looks at it under the microscope, what they see is a certain appearance or characteristics of the cells found in that piece of tissue that has been removed, the so-called cell types or histologic types of lung cancer. And there are two big differentiations in lung cancer. One is lung cancer called small cell lung cancer, and that's a disease affecting about 30,000 Americans each year, about 13% of lung cancer. And for no good reason, the rest of lung cancer is called non-small cell lung cancer. So 87% of people that have a diagnosis of a lung cancer have what they call non-small cell lung cancer. Within the type of lung cancer we call non-small cell, there are two major types in that. One is called adenocarcinoma, the other is called squamous cell carcinoma. And the pathologist assignment to one of those two types is critical to the oncologist as to choosing the best therapy, and I'll get back to that later on. The second thing that has become a standard of lung cancer care now is that in addition to the pathologist visual inspection of the tumor tissues removed to diagnose lung cancer, and in addition to the other tests that are done to help firm up the diagnosis, so-called immunohistochemical tests or IHC tests, they also do tests to look for damaged genes in the lung cancer cells that they remove. So-called genetic testing, genotyping, molecular testing, a lot of different names, but the pathologist takes that tissue that's removed, looks for specific kinds of genetic damage, and again, that information is important to the oncologist because it helps them guide you as to what to expect, because different kinds of genetic damage impart different natural histories of the illness, and also it points the way to specific therapies. Once the diagnosis of lung cancer is confirmed and assured, the next step is the so-called staging of lung cancer. Treatment is dependent to a great extent on stage, and stage refers to the size of the initial lung cancer tumor and also to where that cancer has spread to the lymph nodes and then which lymph nodes into other organs. And again, the pathologic evaluation, the determination of cell type, and the staging is more than anything else what guides your doctors as to the best care for you. So what are the current standards of care? If the cancer is confined to the lung itself, it is a situation best treated by surgery and sometimes with chemotherapy as well. But disease confined to the lung, surgery, and sometimes with chemotherapy. For cancers that are still confined to the chest, they are in the lung and in the structures immediately adjacent to the lung, or lymph glands that are associated with the lung there, with the lung, the treatment is either radiation or surgery, both given with chemotherapy. So chemotherapy would be a common treatment in those situations, and depending on your specific situation, either surgery or radiation given with chemotherapy. And Dr. Werner Wasik will be talking about the use of radiation for primary treatment of lung cancer in the next talk. If lung cancer has spread, the Treatment there is chemotherapy and usually a combination of chemotherapy drugs. And again, when I say spread, I mean spread to another organ in the body, be it a bone, the opposite lung, or the adrenal gland. How is the choice of chemotherapy made? Well, the first decision point is whether or not it is the small cell or the non-small cell lung cancer. For small cell, there is basically one drug that is recommended to virtually every patient with the illness, and that drug is the drug etoposide, and is always given with either cisplatin or carboplatin. So for small cell, one common chemotherapy regimen. For non-small cell, the decisions are a little bit more complicated. The first way that doctors decide which treatment to recommend for non-small cell is to look at the different cell type or histologic type. For those non-small cell lung cancers that are called adenocarcinoma, the treatment of choice there is a chemotherapy drug called pemetrexed, and also in addition to the standard chemotherapies, that DNA-damaging chemotherapies, the use of a second drug, bevacizumab, a drug that disrupts the growth and maintenance of blood vessels, which are vital to the growth and maintenance of lung cancers. So a pemetrexed-containing chemotherapy regimen with either a cisplatin or carboplatin and the drug bevacizumab if you have the adenocarcinoma. If you have the squamous cell carcinoma, it has been shown that a different drug given with cisplatin, a drug called gemcitabine, is more effective than the pemetrexed. So gemcitabine and cisplatin would probably be the most available and tested regimen for squamous cell. And in addition, the drug bevacizumab is not recommended because in the testing of bevacizumab, they learned in patients with squamous cell carcinoma there can be various serious bleeding from the lung, and that it is not safe to give bevacizumab. The other way to help doctors decide which treatment is best for lung cancer, particularly adenocarcinoma, is the use of molecular testing or genetic testing. So as I mentioned before, the pathologist takes the specimens that are obtained at the time the biopsy is done, and they analyze them for genetic changes, changes generally in the DNA of the tumor cell that point to a different stimulus for that lung cancer's occurrence and for the maintenance of its growth. The most common type of genetic mutation is something called EGFR. It occurs in 20 to 30,000 people each year that are diagnosed with lung cancer. And finding that EGFR mutation states that the prognosis is generally somewhat better, and also that treatment with a drug called erlotinib can almost surely lead to shrinkage and an improvement in symptoms and life in general. There's a second type of genetic damage, something called an ALK translocation. That occurs in from anywhere from 8 to 11,000 persons each year. And there's a drug called crizotinib that can also almost surely help shrink the cancer, decrease the symptoms. There are other kinds of mutations that the pathologist can detect. Those mutations tell us some useful information. It tells us not to give a drug like erlotinib or crizotinib because it is very unlikely to work, and you will do much better with a standard chemotherapy. The other thing it does is it can point you to a clinical trial. For every kind of mutation that has been discovered in lung cancer that can lead to the growth and maintenance of lung cancer, there is a drug under study right now, a clinical trial of new drugs specifically attacking those mutations. And if your doctor finds one of those mutations, you may be referred to a clinical trial for that. But again, that giving you another treatment option. If you do not have one of these mutations, or if you do not have sufficient tissue to permit this mutation testing to be done, Chemotherapy is the treatment of choice, and it has been shown to be effective in persons that do not have any kind of mutation. By the way, it's also effective in patients that do have a mutation, so if they don't discover a mutation right away, chemotherapy is a very good choice, and mutation testing can be done later on. The second thing I want to emphasize is that these mutations are in the cancer cell. They are not in you. They cannot be transmitted to your offspring, and it's a condition in the cancer cell, not in you. What about the future? As I mentioned already, there are drugs in testing now for all different types of mutation. There also are there is research looking for other targets for drugs. And just to tell you what an amazing field this is, between Thanksgiving and today, three new targets have been discovered in the treatment of non-small cell lung cancer. ROS fusions, which show a kind of cancer that could be treated with crizotinib, another genetic abnormality, something called RET, R-E-T, and there are drugs in the pharmacy right now, vendetinib and other research drugs that can be used to target that, and additional mutations in the HER2 gene that can also signal a sensitivity to drugs that can attack HER2, things like trastuzumab or lapatinib. So new drugs are coming, new targets are coming. I should mention also that there are developments in other areas of oncology. Surgery is advancing tremendously. More and more patients are having video-assisted surgery. Leads to shorter hospital stays, quicker recovery, equivalent results, and in addition, robotic surgery as well, leading to those outcomes. A couple other points, and then I will finish. The first is managing symptoms. It is the first item of business when lung cancer is suspected that the symptoms lung cancer may have caused need to be attacked. There are two ways of fighting it. There are drugs that specifically treat the symptoms, and then fighting the cancer, of course. So if you have some pain that comes on caused by the lung cancer, you can use pain medications in the short term to treat it. You can use cancer therapy in the long term to kill the cancer and relieve pain. It's also been shown conclusively that if you use all the facilities available for supportive care with chemotherapy, not as a substitute for chemotherapy, but with chemotherapy, that patients do better and they actually live longer. There's a very important paper in 2011 that showed that giving a supportive care along with chemotherapy led to better outcomes than not having that. So a focus on supportive care, even from your very first visit, is something important to A, improving the quality of your life and the length of your life. And so with that, I will stop and turn over to Dr. Werner Wasik to talk about radiation oncology. I will put in that of all the different treatments that we have, radiation therapy is one that a majority of patients will receive at some point in their care, and it's very excellent that we have Dr. Werner Wasik here today to talk about radiation.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chris, for just an outstanding presentation. Very informative, but I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, and very comprehensive. And our next speaker is Dr. Werner Wasik. And Dr. Maria Werner-Wasik is Professor, Residency Program Director, Department of Radiation Oncology, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And Dr. Werner-Wasik is a radiation oncologist, and she's going to address the role of radiation oncology, how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Werner-Wasik.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad that I can speak to those interested in lung cancer, since I've been treating patients with lung cancer for the last 17 years or so. And as Dr. Chris mentioned, most patients with lung cancer will need radiation therapy in one form or the other at some point of their disease. Many times we treat patients up front with radiotherapy, and even more often later for improvement or palliation of their symptoms. So the most common scenario of a patient who comes to my clinic is a patient with stage 3 disease. Stage 3, either A or B, is the disease in which there is a tumor in the lung and involvement of the lymph nodes in the middle of the chest. We call it mediastinum. And for those patients, the definitive treatment, definitive meaning aimed at potential cure is that of concurrent radiotherapy to the chest and lymph nodes with chemotherapy. Concurrent meaning that they both given at the same time. Radiation therapy most likely is given every day on weekdays, Monday through Friday, for 6 to 7 weeks. Small portion or fraction of radiation every day. And chemotherapy may be delivered either once a week or every 3 weeks or in different schedule. Many times also biologic drugs such as bevacizumab or Avastin may be added, although not routinely yet. So this is for stage 3, and then patients are followed very closely, usually with PET CT scans, to see what response they accomplished, or also to watch for any new symptoms of the disease potentially. Also, patients with stage 4 disease, where the tumor has spread outside the chest to other organs in the body, usually derive a lot of benefit from radiation when it's indicated. And the common indications will be bone pain, if it's localized, if we can isolate and if we can find an area of the bone which is a well-circumscribed lesion which causes pain, radiation therapy is very effective. And here you don't have to give radiation for 6 to 7 weeks. Most likely it will be either 1 week or 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks of daily treatments depending on the localization of the tumor and the patient's condition. So very effective for bone pain. One of the symptoms which is very well controlled with radiation therapy to the chest is what something we call hemoptysis, or coughing up blood, due to the tumor invading a portion of the vessel. Even very small blood vessel can cause coughing up blood. And the radiation therapy improves and controls these symptoms completely in over 85% of patients, and does it very quickly. Within 2 weeks of daily small treatments, small fractions, there is improvement. In addition, an event such as development of brain metastasis, which sometimes happens in patients with lung cancer, calls for radiation therapy also, since chemotherapy usually penetrates much less well into the brain than in other organs in the body. And whether or not to use whole brain radiotherapy upfront in combination with focused radiation called radiosurgery, or whether to use radiosurgery upfront, that's an area of debate, but a good radiation center should either be able to deliver both of those modalities, whole brain radiation and or radiosurgery, or be able to refer you for focused radiosurgery. So radiosurgery is sometimes equated by patients with something called a gamma knife. Gamma knife is a machine using radioactive cobalt sources, which is a type of radiosurgery machine. And it's used solely for lesions in the brain. So with gamma knife, one cannot treat other spots in the body. Patients frequently ask us that question. And finally, I would like to mention a new modality of radiation therapy given for small stage 1 lung cancers called SBRT, which is stereotactic body radiation therapy. Radiation oncologists just love long and complicated abbreviations. And the indications for this SBRT are small lung cancers in those patients who for some reason cannot undergo surgical resection of a stage 1 lung cancer. For example, they have poor lung function, they have emphysema, they had a recent heart attack or something of a similar medical condition. And SBRT is very easy in that it requires only between 3 to 5 visits to the radiation department, and we're able to give very large doses to those small tumors without risk of damaging of the normal lung. So it's important for everybody to know that even patients who have very poor lung function are candidates for SBRT and should be referred to the radiation oncologist for an opinion. I would like also to mention that what I just said applies mostly to non-small cell lung cancer, but there's also a role for radiation therapy in small cell lung cancer. in small cell lung cancer, which is a limited disease, meaning only localized in the chest. Again, radiation therapy to the chest with chemotherapy is used. And the unique application of radiotherapy in small cell lung cancer is that of something called the PCI, or prophylactic cranial irradiation, in which, in those patients who had a good response to chemotherapy, we offer irradiation to the whole brain to a low dose to cut down on the chance of tumors arising in the brain later on. You all probably have heard about new modalities of radiation, such as protons or IMRT, and although I don't have time to comment on those specifically here, to a large extent, it's always worth inquiring with your radiation oncologist whether you would be a candidate for any of those novel modalities. I was also asked to talk about clinical trials and their importance. Patients who come to my clinic frequently assume that the doctors always know what treatment is the best and are frequently surprised to find out that that's not always the case. How do we find out that the treatment is better than the other? By running clinical trials. And therefore, I would encourage all patients going to see their doctors to ask whether any clinical trials are available for them. The examples of clinical trials which gave us an answer how to treat patients with stage 3 lung cancer will be those trials from 20 or 30 years ago where we compared patients receiving radiation only versus radiation chemotherapy for stage 3, and we found out that those who got both treatments versus one live longer. So that's how it became standard of care. Another example is the recent trial in which high dose of radiation, 74 gray unit of radiation, was compared to 60 gray, and everybody expected that the higher dose would be better. But preliminary results indicate that that may not be the case. So there is continuously evolving knowledge from the clinical trials, and I would really stress that it's very important for all of us to encourage patients to participate, since nationwide only few percent of patients participate in clinical trials. And finally, communication with your healthcare team is indispensable. I would encourage you strongly to go to those institutions which have multidisciplinary lung clinics in which you can meet both the thoracic surgeon, radiation oncologist, medical oncologist, and those doctors will communicate well in real time and will provide you with answer and plan for your treatment within one visit. I also encourage you to during the visit to ask for contact numbers and how to reach your health team best. What is the access after hours? What is the policy on exchanging emails with your doctor or other healthcare providers? Because that's very important. That's really one of the sources of frustrations for many patients if their doctors or nurses, nurse practitioners are not available. I think I'm going to conclude at this, and I will be happy to take questions later.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Wojnarowski, for an excellent presentation and really, you know, just exceptional in the sense that you covered a lot of areas that people really don't all know the details of, and I think there will be questions for you about more the details of what you discussed because I think people really want to know more about that. And you do also represent, this is a call that is multidisciplinary, as you pointed out, and we have other speakers as well, but this entire call, we have a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist. And our next speaker is a pulmonary clinical nurse specialist. So we clearly, and then our social worker on the call, so basically this is a multidisciplinary call and important for all of you to access that team as well. And our next speaker is Donna Wilson. Donna Wilson is a pulmonary clinical nurse specialist. She's a fitness coordinator, Integrative Medicine Center, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Donna wears many hats, and she's going to discuss working with a pulmonary clinical nurse specialist, so what that means, activity and exercise, and some nutritional concerns and tips that you may have. I now turn this program over to Donna.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. I've been working with lung patients for about 40 years, and I have to say exercise is probably the most beneficial and important thing you can do on your own, whether you're in the act of receiving treatment or you're a survivor, and it's regardless of the stage you're in or your limited activity. You breathe because of the muscles of your chest wall. So if you are inactive and become sedentary, the muscle tone is decreased and your muscle strength decreases. Therefore, strengthening and keeping your cardiovascular system, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, stronger, and it's not doing a huge amount. I mean, I'm going to talk to you about moderate exercises versus vigorous. There have not been very many research projects with lung cancer patients, but there are a handful. And all of the research has demonstrated that it will decrease your level of fatigue, it will decrease your depression, it'll improve your sleep, it will decrease your breathlessness, and improve your quality of life, that you will be able to do more physical things in your home and in your everyday life, that you will not become so short of breath. The programs that have been demonstrated usually run anywhere from about 8 to 12 weeks, and people exercise 2 to 5 times a week. The American Cancer Society many years ago had just even suggested that all cancer patients should exercise 30 minutes a day, whether it just be walking 30 minutes or, you know, combining some stair climbing with walking and some strength training. The cardio fitness that I like to have people do is either walking, and it's usually an endurance perspective that you try to walk for a length of time of maybe 10 to 20 minutes without stopping. You can do it on a treadmill or you can do it on the bike. My goal is that you increase your heart rate so then you have better oxygen transport to all your working skeletal muscles. As you move, every muscle in your body takes oxygen, so therefore you really want to keep everything very efficient. When I talk about moderate exercise, it might be that you would go play doubles tennis with your friends, not singles, because that's a more vigorous exercise. You would go for a walk versus going for vigorous would be a jog. When I talk about strength training, I also incorporate strength training right along with breath training. I find that everyone that has, many women and men that have a lung problem tend to breathe with their upper airway and their chest and their mouth breathers. I really want people to start thinking of breathing in through your nose to stimulate function of using your diaphragm. Your diaphragm is the largest muscle you have for breathing, and it really, you want to maintain it in the best strength you can. So doing little exercises like keeping your mouth closed and breathing in and out of your nose for 15 seconds many times, maybe 10 times a day, can do a little bit of strengthening of that diaphragm. Using your arms and breathing in and out, coordinating your pattern of breathing is important, so you use the muscles of your chest wall. Simple strength training could be a shoulder press. So you use the shoulders, the chest, and the back muscles. You could keep your arms strong for helping you get up and mobilize. Doing a chair squat is extremely important because you use all those large muscles, the legs, on the front of the leg, the quadricep, the back of the leg, the hamstring, and your buttocks. And when you need to use those muscles to get up and down, they take a lot of oxygen. So it's all you work, your whole body works together. So exercise is really a true coordination of breathing as well as it is the movement. So, you know, there are many chair aerobics tapes out. I do chair aerobics with many patients where they start. You can do chair yoga. You can think of things from a cardiovascular standpoint, walk in place, do knee lifts, do squats, things that you can really do in your home that are not hard. If you want to do stair climbing, I know that when I did my research at the hospital with stair climbing, people would look at me and say, oh, I can't do that. I'm like, yes, you can. Never say you can't. You always can try. When you see the stairs, use the handle, use the railing, hold on. But when you put one foot on that step, you breathe out. Before you put your foot on the next step, you breathe out. Remember, the power of your breath is breathing out, not breathing in. You really have to get more air out of your lung to get a better breath in so you can get more oxygen in. So there's lots of things you can do to really maximize that. So either find something locally on a television program or go to a local gym or find something in your area. I can always be found if you have any questions for me as well. But the key is exercise is the key. It does not depend on the stage of your disease. I have many, many people that I work with that are stage four, that we are maximizing their exercise performance so they can continue to maintain a good activity of daily living. So it's really important. If you've had surgery, then you really want to start moving so you don't get stiff from that surgical procedure. All surgical procedures, they cause a little bit of scar tissue around that incision. So you really want to do, if you work with someone, ask about flexibility training. Again, coordinating your pattern of breathing with each exercise. So please, the most important thing I can tell you, don't stop moving. I would hope someday that not only when you get this terrible diagnosis, that you get the prescription for exercise, that you will get a prescription. You'll get your prescription for chemotherapy and other treatments, but you'll also get a prescription for exercise, so you start right away. I'd like to just mention a few things about nutrition. Most importantly, keep your fluid balance, drinking 6 to 8 glasses of water a day, especially if you have if you are a mucus producer and you have some sticky, thick secretions. You really want to make sure that you hydrate yourself well. I think thinking about a nutrition, there is not one perfect diet for someone with this disease. I think the Mediterranean diet, if you looked it up, is a very healthy diet. I think you should look at fruits and vegetables and lean meats and fruits. I think you should not eat processed foods like all the snack foods that we have. They're just wasted calories. I also think it's most important, because you might be working a little harder to breathe, to maintain your protein stores. That means that make sure that you eat enough protein. If you start breaking down muscle when you're sick, you will become weaker and more challenged with each day. So I think it's really important to, if you can't eat a big meal, then eat maybe 5 small meals a day. Or if you find that you need to, you can increase by making some protein shakes for yourself, because this way you can put some good fruits in the shake and get your protein as well. And that does make a very, very important aspect is on the nutrition perspective. I mean, the fruits like grapes and strawberries and blueberries are great, and broccoli and cabbage, which is very appropriate for tomorrow, I might add. Garlic and citrus fruits and tomatoes, all really good fruits and vegetables to stay healthy. But I think if you think about processed foods, those are the ones that are going to have a lot of additives in it. They're also going to have a lot of extra salt. So I think, you know, keeping yourself healthy with small, frequent meals and with a protein and a fruit and vegetables. I would like to say I thank you for having me, and if you have any questions, please ask me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Donna, for a wonderful presentation and really so very informative, and a lot of good tips, and people might have not expected to hear about the importance of exercise and just how important that is for everyone and to make it manageable for everybody. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Wynn Burkle, and Wynn is an oncology social worker. He's director of social service in Long Island. He's also lung cancer program coordinator for Cancer Care. And Wynn is going to address the free psychosocial support services of Cancer Care, and he'll also talk about lung cancer support groups. Wynn?
Hi, Carolyn, and thank you. You know, I'm sure most of us remember the time we moved into our first new home, or even our last new home, and I'm sure we wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon, or maybe a very helpful neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we had things under control. You know, being diagnosed with lung cancer is in some ways very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes really scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very, very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you. Rather than burden folks with heavy medical jargon, lungcancer.org has been designed as the first stop for people who find themselves in the new and strange neighborhood of lung cancer. Using simple-to-understand language in a user-friendly web page format, lungcancer.org helps patients and those who care for them to learn about the basic facts on lung cancer and its treatment. And there's a special section in the website, lungcancer.org, on clinical trials, which not only helps one learn what they're all about, but also provides a special search tool which can assist in finding the lung cancer clinical trial that matches each patient's individual situation. And if a patient wishes to become involved in the clinical trial, there is a tool that allows them to connect with a specially trained clinical trials manager to help them with that whole process. In addition, lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available free of charge for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. Services such as education through Cancer Care's many Connect education workshops provide both disease-specific information, such as today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impacts of cancer. Cancer Care's well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets are available free of charge and are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. To date, we have distributed over 2.5 million copies of these very popular publications. Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services, including subscribing to its popular free monthly e-newsletter, as well as services such as support. You know, Cancer Care's professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of lung cancer, including issues as emotional issues in which they help clients to be assessed and to provide appropriate, helpful psychosocial interventions, dealing with practical issues such as financial assistance through Cancer Care's limited financial assistance program and referrals to the Cancer Care Copay Foundation and other financial resources. Practical issues around referral to resources to the many organizations and agencies established to help cancer patients. Issues on navigating the system and understanding how to best manage the many new relationships involved in healthcare, as well as communications issues. Oftentimes, what do we say, what do we need to be able to say to our healthcare providers, to our family, and to our workplace. They help with social issues and dealing with cancer's impact among family members, friends, the community, and the workplace. Cancer Care social workers provide this assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as individual counseling, face-to-face counseling in the New York Tri-State metropolitan area, as well as online and telephone counseling, and in support groups, face-to-face in the New York Tri-State metropolitan area, online and in telephone. And I can't emphasize enough how important support groups can be to lung cancer survivors who are in treatment or post-treatment. Just the ability to sit down with a group of people who are there doing that or have been there and done that can be so helpful, because lung cancer can create such feelings of isolation, and the support groups, whether they're face-to-face, telephone, or online, just do such a marvelous job of lifting away that sense of being isolated. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of lung cancer. But now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or call us at 1-800-813-HOPE, H-O-P-E. Thank you.
Thank you, Wynn. Wonderful presentation and very compassionate, and also just the concept that, indeed, we are that good neighbor here at Cancer Care, and we want people to take advantage of all these free services. And now, thanks to our speakers, we have lots of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Carolina to bring all of our speakers on board, actually, and Stephanie, actually, to bring all of our speakers on board, and then if you would explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many of your questions as we can. And if we don't get to your questions, you'll call us at the end of the call at Cancer Care, and I'll give you that number at the end of the call. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Allison S. Your line is open.
The question is, has anyone had any experience with patients who have another lung disease? It's called LAM for short, lymphangioleoleomyomatosis, and cancer in regards, lung cancer, in regards to using radiation in addition to chemo or on either one of them?
Thank you for that question, Allison. And Dr. Chris, Dr. Warner-Wasik, would you like to address that question?
I'll defer to Dr. Chris.
Okay. Very unusual situation. What I would urge you to do, this is one of those situations where it probably makes some sense to come to a very specialized center. I don't know what town you're in, but I would look for the closest, like NCI, designated comprehensive cancer center and seek a consultation there. There isn't an easy answer to that question. It's something that you just don't get out of a textbook. It depends a lot on your lung function and other conditions that are affecting you. So I think this is one of those special situations where a consultation at a specialized cancer center is important.
Thank you. Excellent question. And thank you. These are important questions. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Adria L. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hello, yes. Hi, Adria. Your question?
Yeah, my name is John, and my question was, I got great service from Sloan Kettering with Dr. David Finley, a surgeon. He opened up my lung and so I could breathe, and then he referred me locally to Atlantic City so I could get the chemo and the radiation that I needed, and I'm cancer-free now. But
your question, John?
I was wondering, and David Finney's a great doctor, but I was wondering what, why is the surgeon the top of the team? I know they were the first in line, as I've read, in the hierarchy of who cares for you, and why isn't it, say, the oncologist the top of the team? Why is it the surgeon?
Okay. Thank you for that question. And Dr. Chris, can you just address
sure.
that?
Well, I think it depends a little bit upon where the cancer is found at the time it's first discovered. And in general, the person at the top of the team needs to be the one that is sort of delivers the most critical part of your treatment. And for a cancer that is localized to the lung, it would clearly be the surgeon. And surgery alone can cure patients. A medical oncologist can assist the surgeon in improving the cure rates. And in those cases, because of the central role of the surgeon and the central role of surgery, they become the head of the team. I think for the next stage where both radiation and surgery can lead to cure with the medical oncologist, it does get a little bit more divided. Sometimes the radiation oncologist is the first to see the patient, sometimes the surgeon, and the medical oncologist plays a secondary role there. In the most common situation where the cancer has spread when it's discovered, the medical oncologist is the key individual and the one who really leads the team, calls in the surgeon in the appropriate situation, calls in the radiation oncologist in the appropriate situation.
Answer. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Roslyn R. Your line is open.
Hi. I just had a comment on fitness. You can get DVDs and videos at the library for free. And also, something I'd really recommend for this disease is voice training. I learned to sing, and that's a really good workout for your diaphragm, your lungs, and your chest muscles. Okay?
Excellent. Well, thank you.
I would say this is Donna Wilson, and I would say you're absolutely correct. There are many times that when I work with someone, I have a hearing deficit, because the larger the voice, the larger the lung volume. Thank you so much.
Excellent. So we encourage people to sing. Is that Donna? Was that
correct?
Okay. All right.
And oh, could I just throw in another comment there too? You know, many people fighting lung cancer have difficulties with their voice, and I can't encourage them enough to get voice training when they find that your voice has been affected by the illness. This is slightly different than the question that was asked, but also you know, there are several kinds of medical procedures that can improve the quality of your voice, and if your voice has been harmed by cancer or cancer treatment, make sure you discuss that with your nurse and doctor, because there are some very effective interventions in addition to voice training.
And actually, Donna, can you say a little bit about what voice training entails, just so people understand what that is?
Well, I think it's to lengthen. What you do is you learn to lengthen your time of breathing out. So you utilize your diaphragm. Like if you think of someone when they are singing and the length of their note that they're getting out, it's that long length. So you do it long and slow. And the air then comes out through the vocal cords very slowly. Whereas, so you're controlling it, the voice out through the vocal cords. So the diaphragm is working the whole time. So it really makes a difference that you're trying to lengthen the time of breathing out. It's easier for me to teach people to breathe out by them actually using the word, say, ah. So I have them breathe in, and if they say the word ah and they do it out long for a count of 6 or 8 or 12, they can lengthen the time they get the air out, and it does it slow. And by doing that, it just really relaxes them as well. So it's really lengthening the breath out.
Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Ken F. Your line is open.
Yes, I wanted to find out how frequently non-small cell cancer metastasizes to the brain, and whether there's a standard screening procedure to detect that if it does happen.
Mm-hmm. I will be happy to take that question. The rate of brain metastasis or spread to the brain in non-small cell lung cancer is between 17% to 20% or so. So about one-fifth of the patients will have this spread, as at least we will know about it. Many more may have some small lesions which don't manifest themselves. Then you're asking how to discover it. Actually, again, what patients find somewhat disconcerting, we don't do routine tests to discover that. When the patient develops symptoms, then brain MRI or CAT scan are obtained and action is taken to treat. Basically, the only time when routinely we would do imaging of the brain would be upon presentation, when a patient presents with apparent early stage disease as part of the staging or evaluating the extent of the disease, an imaging of the brain is requested.
Dr. Chris,
if I could just add.
Yes,
yeah, just to add that, just as Dr. Werner-Wasik said, I think it's very concerning to many people that we don't routinely check for it. But the truth of the matter is, where we have tried to do that in patients, we were unsuccessful. So rather than put somebody who is not having any symptoms of that illness through additional scanning, we feel that it's not indicative, because where it has been used, particularly in small cell lung cancer, where the spread to the brain is even more common than in non-small cell, we just think it's putting people through tests that don't lead to any ultimate improvement in their outcome or in decency of their life.
If it does occur, the various treatments that can be offered to people.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. The treatment's extraordinarily successful for spread to the brain. I wish we had chemotherapies as effective as radiation is for treatment of brain metastases. And Dr. Werner-Wasik, would you like to just give a short litany of the various ways radiation can be used nowadays?
Well, I sort of mentioned that for lung cancer in particular, whole brain radiotherapy is the mainstay, and we talked about use of focused radiation or radiosurgery in addition to whole brain or sometimes instead, and we also talked about this prophylactic cranial irradiation, which is standard now for cutting down on the chance of brain metastasis in patients with small cell lung cancer who respond to chemotherapy.
So there are a lot of treatments, and people should realize that there are treatments for this. So that's very important. That's why we have all these different disciplines on the call today, so you understand that.
Well, but just, again, whole brain radiation works about 8 out of 10 times. It leads to controlling that problem in the brain and letting people get on with their life. So it's a very effective treatment.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, this has been an extraordinary call. And indeed, as Dr. Chris has just said, the whole point of our doing this program is that you have information so you can get on with your life as you want to live it and that you can work so effectively with your healthcare team. And we hope you're leaving this call today feeling more informed. I want to thank our speakers, who are just extraordinary. I want to thank each of them. I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions, because your questions allowed us to elaborate on points more so that everybody could benefit from your comments. Now, I do just want to actually, in concluding, although the program will soon conclude, I don't want you to think that then you're left all by yourself again. You are now a part of all the services that Cancer Care offered, and I do want to just briefly review them again. Wynn did an excellent job covering them already. But nevertheless, we do have a staff of 45 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide a host of helping services to you, and they're free. We provide financial assistance. We provide practical help. We provide counseling services and support groups, both on the telephone and online. And we have, of course, these workshops, and we have fact sheets and booklets and, of course, websites, lungcancer.org and cancercare.org. So most importantly, I would not want anyone to leave this call thinking that you're alone. If you didn't get to ask your question, you can simply call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and that's a good way to call us in general. Or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. So you're now part of a community of support, and we want you to know that if any time you have a question, a concern, or you just want to talk to one of our social workers, just give us a call. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop. You may disconnect.